Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Redemption Hill podcast. We are a community of people learning the way of Jesus to bless our city of Boise, Idaho, and beyond. Redemption Hill is a unique place. We are a collective of micro churches that do life together throughout the week and gather on Sundays to grow, worship, and celebrate what God is doing in our city. You are invited to join us Sundays at 9 a.m. at Discovery Church in Boise, where you can find the community you need in any season of your life. More details can be found at redemptionboise.org. Up next is the teaching segment from this week's Sunday gathering. Afterwards, stay tuned for more information on how to get connected at Redemption Hill.
Good morning. Good morning. Good to be with you. It's been a few weeks. I had a little heart procedure, and they wouldn't let me preach for a couple weeks, so I was fine. That was just them, you know, being, you know how Jesse and Andrew are, very domineering. That's the word that everybody uses for them. No, I'm doing great, and thanks for all you who've been praying and caring for us. This week we are back in Genesis. Last week Jesse had a great sermon on Jacob's ladder and that moment where God met him on the road, and I think that you should go back and listen to it if you weren't here. It was very good. I actually did. I mean, I let Claude do a transcription and then give me notes. No, I listened to that one. I want to start with something you probably don't expect from a Genesis sermon, which is physical therapy. Who here enjoys seeing the physical therapist? I'm not seeing a lot of that. Okay, a few of you. Probably those of you who need some mobility. Yeah. If you've ever done like real physical therapy, not like warm towel, light stretching type, not the you're getting your health insurance to pay for a massage kind of physical, you know what I'm talking about? Like we're talking about, you know, you're going in and they're helping you, but it doesn't feel like help. It feels like torture. It feels like they're making it worse even. Like you walk away from physical therapy going, I don't know if that was a good thing or not. You're working muscles, maybe you haven't fired a month. Your therapist is like calm and encouraging, but also just like merciless. You know what I'm talking about. You know these people. I've had a few bouts of some serious PT along the way. When I was 13, I broke my leg and it dislocated my tibia off of my heel. It was a nasty little break. And I went and saw our family friend Doug, who was a physical therapist, twice a week. And it was this kind of like sort of dreaded hellscape of machines that inflict intentional pain. There's one called a Biodex, which is basically like you're seeing how far you can push your muscles as they go. And it was horrible. Just truly, I wouldn't have found my mobility as quickly as I did. I was back in sports in 6 weeks because he put me through this incredibly painful thing. Here's the thing, when you have physical therapy, no one's making you go. If you don't go, your physical therapist will stop scheduling them. But nothing's stopping you. You could go home, back in the day, they just would give you like opioids. Now they don't, they just give you, NSAIDs. But if you don't go through the therapy, the injury doesn't heal right. You learn to compensate, you favor the hurt side, you develop bad patterns of motion. And the thing that was supposed to heal, it calcifies into something worse or something that's not as functional. And the newest science, if you've had any surgery recently, they're even saying that broken bones need movement and weight much earlier than ever before. And it helps protect the structures and the muscle around them. So orthopedic surgeons are trying to get you to move like the same day as surgery, which is wild. But the therapy itself is mercy. Even when it doesn't feel like it, it's caring. And that's the story that we're in today of Jacob. Last week we were in Bethel. Jacob, the deceiver, the heel grabber, the man who stole his brother's blessing. He ran. He fell asleep in the dirt. God shows up. The stairway between heaven and earth, which is actually Jesus and his presence with us. Angels descending and descending, and when the voice of God says, I am with you, I will not leave you, I will do what I have promised. This is an unconditional covenant that God has made for Jacob and his family. Jacob wakes up and says, well, surely God was in this place, and I did not know it. He sets up a stone, he pours oil on it, makes a vow. But like Jesse noted last week, the vow was still kind of if. It was conditional. If you do this, then you will be my God. Jacob was leaning in, but hadn't given in to God. He's not a new man yet. He has a new promise. He has a new encounter, but the old patterns are still running underneath. Many of us, we go through a conversion experience where we're transformed spiritually by Jesus, and then we wake up the next morning, we're like, man, that felt great. And then what do? The same old patterns of our lives follow us into this new life. The grace of Bethel was real for Jacob, but it wasn't enough on its own to transform him. Some things, they don't yield in moments, but they yield over years of time. And today is about when the years stretch and train and change you. To understand what happens with Jacob in Haran, you need to understand the world that he walked into. This is not our world. This is like Bronze Age, ancient Near East. There's no dating apps. There's no dinner in a movie. Marriage in the ancient Near East, it was an economic transaction conducted between families, specifically between the patriarchs of the family, the father of the bride. He holds all the cards because he's got the goods. He decided who the daughters were marrying. He sets the terms. He had complete authority, and the culture backed him up. They used the culture as a stick to beat off and keep people away who wanted what they wanted to take. And when a man wanted to marry a woman, he paid what was called a mohar, which is a bride price. Now, this has been, I think, misconstrued in modern times, but you're not purchasing a woman, but you're compensating the family for the loss of that family member, demonstrating that you have enough to take care of them and to be taken seriously. Now, when I wanted to marry Malia, my father-in-law said no the first time. He's smarter than you'd think, actually. He said no, and I was 20, so like, it's probably smart. If a 20-year-old ever wants to date my kids or marry my kids, I'll be like, let's give it a couple years. Let's see how stuff turns out when your frontal lobe, you know, finishes. But he had a few things he wanted me to do, like finish school and get a job and, you know, just like little things, just to show I'm a promising prospect. That's what's happening here. So Jacob shows up in Haran with nothing. He's fled his brother. He's leaving. He's going to where his uncle is to marry within his tribe, his family, his cousin. It's weird, but it was more normal then. He fled Esau with the clothes on his back. He had no flock, no silver, no cattle. And so he offers the only thing that he has, which is time. He goes to this well. He's trying to find his family. There's this sheep herder who comes up, and he goes, do you know this? You know my uncle, Laban? And this guy goes, yeah, these are his flocks. And then the music starts. Dun, dun, dun. And Rachel walks in, and he's just overwhelmed. He, like, can't even think. He's just like, oh, my gosh, I'll do whatever it takes to win this woman, but I have nothing to offer. So what does he offer? He says, I'll give you 7 years. 7 years of free labor if you'll let me have Rachel. That will be my mohar, my bride price. And he does it. Now, figure 7 years with the wages of a, you know, he was probably a teenager, probably like 15 to 17. So he's not worth a lot. You know, the labor's maybe worth 25 grand a year. But even then, we're talking multi-hundred-thousand-dollar bride price he's paying. 7 years. The text says it seemed like only a few days because of his love for her. It's like a movie. That's the one tender thing that we see of Jacob that he does. And there's like something in him that, like, love and passion, like, drives generosity. He loves someone long enough to wait, and that's passion and desire and reward that God used to help develop Jacob's character into what would happen next. We live in a world that has we've made sex into either an ultimate of individual expression, or we've made it something that's problematic. But there's something really good when a young man or a young woman says, I want love, and they're willing to sacrifice for it. that transforms us from children into adults. And we want to stoke that. We want to allow that to happen in our children when they say, I want to build a family. That takes a whole bunch of things falling into place that they have to grow into. And then we all know that that's just the start. When you start a family and then you start to have children, it transforms everything. But this is a part of God's plan for Jacob. And then he has the wedding. And here's what you need to know about ancient Near Eastern weddings. The bride was heavily veiled, okay? Not just like our veils, you can definitely see who it is underneath. Think Middle East today, you know, full veils. You cannot see their face, you know, maybe a little slit in their eyes. But the betrothal ceremony through the wedding feast, they're veiled, and the veil says this woman is set apart. She belongs to someone. Don't touch her. She's under a covenant. And the feast, the Hebrew word for feast is mishtha, which it's the root to drink, okay? So don't think like Baptist punch wedding. Set that aside. We're talking like family in the Hamptons for the weekend kind of wedding, okay? No one's truly sober from start to finish. Everybody's drinking the whole time. It lasts 7 days. It involved a substantial amount of wine, and it took place by torchlight at night. Okay, so all those things are important. So when Laban comes, he says, here's your bride. Jacob's probably a little tipsy at least. And he gives Leah to Jacob, Rachel's older sister. Darkness, veil. There's the weight of 7 years of anticipation. I don't think in the darkness of that tent, Jacob was thinking to make sure this is the right woman. You know, he's probably never been with her in a physical way, so he doesn't know. This has been a week-long feast, and Jacob does not see Leah's face until he wakes up in the morning, opens up the tent, and goes, this is why you do not drink for 7 days. Jacob opens his eyes. It's Leah. He goes to Laban, and Laban's answer is not, oh, gosh, I gave you the wrong daughter. Here's you got to hear what Laban said. He doesn't apologize. He doesn't explain. He says, it's not done in our place to give the younger before the firstborn. Now, okay, remember Jacob's story. Jacob's story is about the younger usurping the older's place. And so God and Laban are making a point here. Okay, they're making a point about the order of things. And that this is a real custom. The older daughter always married first. It wasn't a law written somewhere. It's just a strong cultural expectation. The kind of thing that everyone in Haran knew, but not people who had come from Canaan. Laban knew it the entire time that Jacob was working for Rachel. He could have said something. He chose not to. He used a legitimate cultural practice as cover for a calculated deception. You see, Laban out-Jacobed Jacob. He out-deceived the deceiver. He out-schemed the schemer. The man who tricked his father who couldn't see, by wearing his brother's clothes and stealing what wasn't his, that man just woke up next to a woman who in the dark he didn't know wasn't the one that he had paid for. Here's the thing about that Hebrew word for deceive in this passage. What is that word? It's Jacob's name. So the very verb that says Laban deceived Jacob, it is Jacob out, Jacob, Jacob. The heel grabber, the supplanter, the one who deceives, he said to Laban, well, why have you deceived me? Why have you Jacobed me? Now that could be a slur very easily, we really don't want to use, but that's the word that he uses. He spent 20 years in Haran. He works another 7 years for Rachel and finally gets her. And then he and Laban spend years out scheming each other over the livestock. Jacob figures out how to breed the spotted and speckled animals. And Laban keeps changing the terms of the deal. Jacob countermaneuvers. God blesses Jacob despite it all. And Jacob prospers. But the relationship deteriorates with his father-in-law. And eventually, God tells Jacob, it's time to go home. And Jacob packs up his wives, his children, and his flocks in secret, and he slips away. This is very Jacob. He gets what he wants, he takes up in the night, and he leaves again. Laban chases him down. They argue. They make a treaty. He gives them some stuff. Jacob then turns south, goes home towards Canaan, towards the reckoning, Esau. Laban gave Jacob something, much more precious than anyone at the time understood. I want to slow down here because something happened in Jacob in those 20 years that the text doesn't announce, it just shows you. Jacob now knows what Esau experienced. He had gotten it from Laban. Think about what Esau had experienced. He came home from hunting. He made his father's favorite food. He came in to receive the blessing that was his by birthright, the blessing that would define his future, his identity, his standing before God and men, and he finds that it has been stolen from him by his brother through Jacobing, deception, a costume and a lie, and the exploitation of an old man's blindness. That's what Jacob did to Esau. Now, Jacob has lain in a tent in the dark and opened his eyes to find that someone had used that same deception and darkness and his own desire against him to give him something that he didn't choose. He knows this feeling from the inside. He knows what it's like to work hard for something and have the terms changed on you. He knows what it's like to be receiving end of a smile that's really covering a scheme. He knows what it's like to be played by someone who had more power and used it without mercy. God didn't lecture Jacob about what he did to Esau. There's no grand sermonette from God at Jacob's ladder or in the story we're going to read today. The text says that he put Jacob in the hands of a man more cunning than him, and he let it run for 20 years. That's the mercy. Not uncomfortable mercy, but costly kind of mercy. It was experiential mercy. In our house, my favorite thing is natural consequences. It's what we do. We, like, one of my sons just cut his hair with scissors this week. You will see it on his head. Many of you saw it this morning. And he's living with the public shame of that because we refused to fix it. The natural consequences themselves drive true transformation. Hopefully he doesn't read back on these old YouTube videos when he's older. You see, this is the kind that doesn't just tell you what you did, but makes you feel what you did. You cannot be reconciled to your brother until you know in your body what you did to him. So when Jacob hears that Esau is coming with 400 men, the text says he's greatly afraid and distressed. He uses two words, fear and dread. I don't think that's like survival instinct. I think underneath the fear is something that's been building for 20 years in Jacob. A recognition, and probably the first time that Jacob is not just running away from consequences, but feels guilt for what he's done. Because scumbags like Jacob and like me, we don't feel remorse, we feel regret. We don't feel guilt, we're running away from consequences. He deserves what's coming. Jacob deserves to have Esau's army roll through and destroy him and take what's his. For the first time, he actually understands the cost of his deception. And Jacob sends the messengers ahead to Esau. The messengers come back. They're like, Esau's coming, 400 men. So Jacob does two things at the same time. He prays and he schemes, because that's what Jacob just can't help but do. And the prayer is worth reading carefully. We're going to put up on the screen here. It's one of the first genuine prayers in all of Jacob's story. It's not a negotiation opener. It's not a conditional vow. Here's what he says. O God, my Father. Do we have that? We're working on it? Okay, that's right. Here we go. O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. I came over the same Jordan with only my staff, and now I've become two full camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, for I am afraid. Something is breaking in Jacob. 20 years of Laban, and something is starting to soften inside of him. But then he organizes this elaborate series of gift convoys to send ahead of him. like wave after wave of livestock meant to buffer Esau's anger before they meet. He's still working the angles. The prayer is real, and the scheme is real, and they exist at the same time. And that's Jacob. That's a lot of us. I don't.
Genesis 32:9.
Yeah, Genesis 32:9. There you go. I didn't have it written in here because it was on the slide. I do this all the time. Do you guys do that? Where you pray but you scheme, like you kind of hit both angles in case one doesn't work out. Like I'll get stuck in business and I'm not sure like where the money or the time or the people are going to come from, and so like. I start praying with real faith, trusting God to work, and then I also start working the problem, trying to figure out how I can solve it on my own. There's kind of three types of people. Like one person trusts God, and they're like, God's going to provide no matter what, so I don't have to do anything. I'm just going to wait for God to provide. These people are very frustrating people to hang out with. And then when God provides for them, you even matter because they didn't do anything. They're just like sitting around waiting. Drives you nuts. The second type of person, they trust God, but like me, they don't wait around for God to provide. They just do it on their own. And they're like, look how God provided through my scheming and my work. Isn't that amazing? And then the third doesn't trust God at all, but worries constantly and strives to care for everything themselves. Raise your hand if you can find yourself in one of those three camps. All right, I thought I'd hit everybody. Jacob sends his family across this ford of Jabbok. He sends everything across, praying that his scheme will work. And then in verse 20 of chapter 32, it says, I will try to appease him by sending gifts ahead of me. When I see him in person, perhaps he'll be friendly to me. So the gifts were sent on ahead while Jacob spent the night in camp by himself. During the night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two servant wives, and his 11 sons and crossed the Jabbok River with them. After taking them to their side, he sent ahead all of his possessions. And then he left Jacob all alone in the camp. And a man came, and he wrestled with him until the dawn began to break. When the man saw that he would not win the match, he touched Jacob's hip and wrenched it out of its socket. And then the man said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. What is your name? The man asked. He replied, deceiver, striver, Jacob. Your name will no longer be deceiver, the man told him. From now on, you will be called Israel. Because you have striven, you have fought with God, with men, and have won. Please tell me your name, Jacob said. Why do you want to know my name? The man replied. And then he blessed Jacob there. And then Jacob named that place Peniel, which means the very face of God. For he said, I've seen God face to face, and yet my life has been spared. The sun was rising as Jacob left Peniel, and he went limping on because of the injury to his hip. Even today, the people of Israel don't eat the tendon near the hip socket. I don't know if people were doing that before, but they didn't anymore, because of what happened that night when the man strained the tendon of Jacob's hip. So Jacob is alone. He sent everyone on ahead. And I want you to feel that, because he's stripped away. Once Esau has taken all of his stuff and his wives and his family, Jacob will be left there alone. Everything that gives him status and cover and distraction, that all might possibly appease Esau of his anger, but all of it's on the other side of the water, and Jacob is left alone on the bank in the dark. You see, God won't be appeased by stuff and wives and livestock. He wants Jacob to become who he was meant to be. Before Peniel, there's always this Jabbok, this crossing point where everything that gets sent ahead of you and you are left with nothing to hide between you and God. Just yourself and whatever God's about to do. you're left bare. God doesn't tend to his deepest work in the midst of a crowd normally. He waits for the dark. He waits until we're stripped of all the things that we're hiding behind. And then a man, no introduction, no announcement, wrestles with him until the breaking of the day. No warning, just a man in the dark grappling with Jacob on the bank of a river. This is a weird, wild story. Like, I can tell you, one time I was camping and I'm in my sleeping bag and I'm with some buddies and they think it'd be funny to throw water on my face. Has anybody ever had some similar happen at a camp or something? You know, you're in a sleeping bag and your arms are inside. This is, you know, like a little hooded sleeping bag. We're backpacking up above McCall. And have you ever tried to get out of a sleeping bag quickly? You know, you're just like, you know, just like trying to flip your way out. Now imagine you're by yourself on the bank of a river, and all of a sudden there's someone wrestling you. Now imagine Sean Huntington comes up behind you, Ollie, and you're not ready. He's got you in a double Nelson, and you're like, what am I, you know, like you're just like, I'm lost. That's what we're talking about. For Jacob, the dark is an important part of the story. Because the dark is the place that he deceived and the place that he was deceived. His father's darkened eyes. He meets God in a dream in the dark on the way to Haran. He's tricked in the dark into marrying Leah. And now in the dark, he's overwhelmed by a stranger wrestling with him. And Jacob fights. Because Jacob's been fighting his whole life. That's who he is. He's a scrapper. He will not let go. And at some point, this man, and the text is deliberately ambiguous here, letting you feel the mystery, like in the revelation. He sees that he cannot prevail against Jacob. So he touches Jacob's hip socket. He dislocates it. And Jacob, wounded, still won't let go. I have a brother who's exactly 5 years older than me. And I was taller than him when I was 12. Like, I was much taller than him pretty quickly. And he's like 5'6". He's a short guy. But he is a scrapper. He will fight you to the death, believe me. When I hit 17, we were at one of our church camps. And we were, you know, as happens with boys, we started to wrestle. And we got into the position where both of us were prepared to break the other's limb to finish the fight. Because we needed to establish that we could, you know. Anybody here have brothers understand what I'm talking about? There's like a moment where you go, oh, we're done. We don't have to fight anymore because we have determined that we can destroy one another. Whether it's good or not, we have determined where we fit. God could have ended this fight at any moment. This is the God who created all things. He wasn't overwhelmed by Jacob. The one who could not prevail against Jacob is the same God who spoke the cosmos into existence. He's not struggling. The match is not competitive. He is staying. The wound is not about God losing control of the situation. The wound is God choosing the minimum necessary force to break Jacob's self-sufficiency. The hip's dislocated. It's not destroyed. A dislocated limb is painful, but not debilitating. God is precise with his mercy. He could have thrown Jacob into the river. He could have leveled him. He could have touched one joint. And that is enough to show Jacob that he has been holding on, not because he is strong, but because God has been letting him grab hold of him. The wound is a mercy of God. And then he says, what is your name? The question's not informational. He's not going, I need to give you a blessing, so I need to know the correct name to give the blessing to. He's asking Jacob to say it out loud. And we talked about this early on in the Genesis story. In the ancient world, and Carmen Imes unpacks this just incredibly, a name is not a label. A name is an identity. It's your vocation. It is your public self. So to name something is to define what it is, its relationship, its place and order. When God asks, what is your name? He's asking, who are you? What do you do in this world? And Jacob answers, deceiver. He answers, schemer, striver, heel grabber. He says, Jacob. the one who came out of the wound, holding his brother's foot, working the ankle, the one who put on the brother's skin and stood in the brother's place and took what wasn't his, the one who woke up next to Leah and spent 20 years being out-schemed by Laban and still couldn't stop the scheming, Jacob. He has to say it. He has to own that his name has meant before he can receive a new one. And then he says, your name will no longer be Jacob, the deceiver, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men, and you have prevailed. This is the name that becomes God's people, Israel. It's in our world today, 3,000 years later. It sounds like a geography. It sounds like a place. It sounds like it's on a map, like archaeology, like something behind glass in a museum. But hear it fresh. Israel, that is the name of our people, the one who strives with God. This is the name of the people of God now. Every person who stands in the covenant line, every person who says, I belong to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, every person who has gathered at the table and broken bread, this is the body of Christ. It's named after this night, not after the Red Sea, not after Sinai, named after a man in the dirt at Jabbok, hip dislocated, refusing to let go. The people of God are named after a wrestling match. Here's the reality. You cannot belong to God without striving. You cannot passively come to God. Which means, and I want to say this as directly as can, you cannot be part of God's people without striving. You don't get the name by having it figured out. You don't get the name by performing the right religious behaviors in the right sequence. You don't get that name by staying comfortable and clean and not asking the hard questions. You get the name the way that Jacob got it, by getting in the ring and refusing to tap out. The church is not the community of the certain. It's not the gathering of the people who've never doubted or never struggled or never lay awake at 3 a.m. wondering if this is all real. The church is Israel. The church is the community of people who have wrestled with God and by marked with it because we have not let go. And this reframes a lot of things for us, that your doubt is not disqualifying. Otherwise, there'd be no one here. It might be the beginning of a real encounter. Your questions are not the opposite of faith. They might be the thing that gets you close enough to grapple and wrestle with God. Your dark night might be Jabbok. Your wound might be the evidence that you were close enough to be touched by God, because you have fought with God and with men and have prevailed. And prevailed doesn't mean won. That's a bad translation. Jacob doesn't pin God to the ground. He could barely stand. Prevailed means that he didn't let go. He held on through the dark, through the wound, through the exhaustion, until the blessing came. That's what it means to be God's people, Israel. Jacob means the place Peniel, the ones who see the face of God. I've seen him face to face, and yet I have been delivered. We would expect to die. That's what the ancient assumption was. To see God was to be consumed by his presence and taken away. But instead, Jacob is given a new name, a wound, a sunrise, a new day. And he walks across the river towards his brother, limping. So imagine the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip, dragging along. He walks different now. He's going to walk different for the rest of his life. The text tells us that Israel kept this dietary custom about the hip. The people of God, they remembering that night, they want to remember that they strove with God. They carry the memory of the wound in their bodies. It becomes part of how they live. And for us, we've got to consider how this story and what it means for us. So if you're a striver like Jacob, if you're somebody who's always trying to grasp for the next thing, scheme and find a way to out-duel, out-scheme God and men. You've been managing outcomes your whole life, working the angles, staying one step ahead, keeping all the plates spinning so that nothing falls. You've convinced yourself that this is strength. But when you're honest, and I think some of us are ready to be, it's just fear. It's the deep, unspoken belief that if you stop controlling it, everything's going to fall apart. Jacob's strategies didn't transform him. 20 years of scheming, 20 years of outmaneuvering, 20 years of staying one step ahead, and at the end of it, he's still the same man on the inside, afraid, alone on the bank of a river, running from his brother. The thing that changed Jacob wasn't a better plan. It was a night in the dirt with God where he finally couldn't win by his own terms. There's a version of you, if you're willing to strive with God, that exists on the other side of this. The other side of the fight that you've been avoiding. The stripping down. But it starts with moving towards the hard things and those conversations that you've been avoiding. It starts by embracing silence and solitude and wrestling with God in those places. For some of you, you've been in deeply distressing, hard circumstances. When you look at Jacob, he was suffering under Laban. He was lied to, he was cheated, but it's not an accident. Those difficult things that you're in right now, that situation that is humbling you, frustrating, and exposing you, it may be the physical therapy session that you didn't sign up for, but God knew you needed. He's not absent from your hard thing. He might be using it to give you the knowledge and understanding that you couldn't have gotten any other way. God takes you to your places of wounding and lets you be formed in those places. Sometimes God uses Labans in our lives to make us feel that what we've done to our Esaus. Let me say that again. Sometimes God uses the Labans in our life to make us feel what we've done to our Esaus. The people we've cheated, we have to get cheated to see it. The places where we've been angry and hurtful, we have to be hurt to see it. The places where we've been frivolous and have given away what God has entrusted to us, it has to be taken from us. God takes us to those places. It doesn't feel like mercy, but it is. But here's the deal. You have to stop rescheduling your physical therapy appointment and instead find the transformation that happens when you embrace the pain for the sake of healing. You can either learn to walk and suffer through the work, or you can suffer with debilitating pain, chronic illness, heart disease, and diabetes. Choose your heart. But for some of us that have been running away from pain, we have to embrace suffering so that we can move through it. For some of us need surrender. Jacob wrestled all night. He didn't go quietly. He fought hard, tooth and nail. And I want to tell you, that's okay. You can be someone who holds on. Surrender is not a passivity. It's not the easy path. Sometimes it's the most exhausting thing that you're going to do. But holding on in the dark when everything in you wants to either win or quit, maybe it's the relationships that are being fought for survival. Maybe it's when your partner stops fighting. That's the end of the relationship. You've got to press in. But at the end of the night, there's a name that Jacob doesn't have before, a name that he didn't earn, a name that God gave him in the middle of the fight. Here's the deal. You are not too gone. You are not too complicated. You are not too broken for God to draw near to you in your place. You might just be at your Jabbok. You might be in the moment of transformation. You might be seeing healing and learning your true identity in your struggle, and that's okay. The story of Genesis is about God crafting people who will bear his name. They will be his presence in the world. The ones who will bless all of creation and bear his presence in Christ. The sun came up. Jacob limped, but he was Israel now. The wound that he carried was not the tragedy of his story. It was the proof that God would not let him go away untransformed. The proof that he had been close enough to be touched by God. The proof that he held on long enough to be changed. The proof that God stayed in the ring until the work was done. Do not let go in your striving with God, because at daybreak, you'll be given a new identity. You'll be given a new purpose, and a limp that will mark you for a lifetime. Let's pray together. Jesus, we want you, and we also want to not suffer. And they're mutually exclusive because this world comes with suffering. We cannot avoid it. And so, Jesus, we ask that you turn it into purpose, that you take our suffering and our places where we need to be formed and transformed. We pray that you take those things and you start to weave together a new purpose and identity for us. We pray that we will be left alone without all the things we use to distract ourselves from you. And that in that darkness, in those dark places where we have fought on our own, that we will strive with you instead. That we will get into the wrestling ring and say, I'm not going to let go until I get your blessing. I'm not going to let go until you tell me who I truly am. I'm not going to let go until you restore and heal me. Jesus, we need you. All the good things are things that you're doing and the things that you're letting us experience. I pray that we don't miss out because we're complaining about the pain and the suffering in the middle of what we need, which is the things that will shape us. In your holy name we pray. Amen.
Thanks again for listening. Make sure to subscribe to get the weekly episodes in your podcast feed. You can find out more on how to get connected with Redemption Hill at redemptionboise.org/connection, where you can fill out the Connect card and start your journey today. For regular encouragement throughout the week, follow us on Instagram at Redemption Boise. We are so glad you're here and are excited to accompany you in your story with God. We hope to see you soon.